This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Joyful, joyful.
Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. This is the show where we talk about spirituality and sexuality for our community.
And you're on the Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9 every Thursday night between 8 and 9. Tonight you're with Rachel and...
David.
Nice to see you guys tonight. So tonight we're going to have a bit of a chat about our holy day of the week, which is St. Valentine's Day, obviously. And then we're going to listen to an interview between Tal and Akai Padmashali about some intersex... things in India, so we'll hear more about that later. So first, we are going to have a bit of a chat about St. Valentine's Day.
Is that coming up soon?
Yes.
How soon?
Right now, soon.
About 4 days. 4 hours away, isn't it?
No, Saturday, 14.
It's 28. Oh, 28 hours away. That's all right then. So St. Valentine's Day, Rachel, what's it all about?
Look, we have learnt so much about St. Valentine's Day in our research. So everyone thinks it's all about like gifts and flowers and chocolate and stuff.
But that's what it is, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it had some meaning behind it. Apparently lots of meanings behind it. So St. Valentine's Day was named after some Christian martyrs that were known as Valentinus or Valentine. So there was three of them, according to... history books, that there were three Christians named either Valentinus or Valentine that all were executed at some point in time and became Christian martyrs.
Three distinct Valentines.
Yes, yes. More information about some than others. It seems that their biographies were a little bit muddled up over time, so we've got some information about that. But
so what? What was the most interesting thing about them?
So the one of them, he was Saint Valentinus, and a popular biographical account of Saint Valentine of Rome states that he was imprisoned for performing weddings to soldiers who were forbidden to marry, and he was ministering to Christians who were persecuted under the Roman Empire. But interesting fact, he was sent to jail for doing so. And in jail, the jailer who locked him up had a blind daughter and said to Saint Valentine, who probably was not a saint at that point in time, he would have just been Valentinus.
I reckon
Valentine,
so.
Yes. Said, if you heal my daughter of her blindness, then you will be forgiven and you will be... you know, what's the wiping the slate clean type thing? And he did. He healed the daughter.
Which is rather interesting. From what we've read, it sounds as if he had been discussing Jesus and whether Jesus was real or not. And that's when the proclamation came down to say, perform a miracle.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is a big ask.
It's definitely a big ask. So, yeah, he put his hands over the daughter's eyes, just as Jesus did in the Bible, and he did perform a miracle.
And you can understand that with a miracle like that occurring, the jailer is going to very quickly change his mind about things.
Most definitely. I certainly would be. So.
And I understand that having done that, the jailer then essentially... almost gave St. Valentine, or Valentine as he was then, free rein and the ability to set his own terms.
Yes, but he ended up back in jail. Those facts are a little bit foggy as to when he ended up back in jail, and he was then executed. But before his execution, he had signed a letter, "Your Valentine."
That sounds a little familiar, that one.
That does. So I think that tradition has been kept over time. So Valentine's Day is celebrated by many Christian denominations. It's also known as the Feast of St. Valentine, and that's by the Anglicans and Lutherans.
So it's given a few different names around the place for what essentially is the same celebration.
Definitely.
Which has converted into very much a commercial celebration these days.
It's changed so much over time.
We might have a chat about it a little later.
We will get back to that later. So you're on the Spirit Lounge. So coming up now, we're speaking with Tal. He's speaking to Akai Padmashali, the trans activist in India. So we're going to listen to that now.
Tonight I'm speaking to Akai Padmashali over in India. She is a trans woman, social activist, and founder member of Ondade, which translates to convergence. Welcome to the Spirit Lounge, Akai.
Thank you.
So, Akai, we're talking tonight about Hijra. I think it usually translates to eunuch, is usually what people use when they refer to Hijra in India. But maybe you could tell us what is classified as a Hijra.
See, basically, the terminology used as a eunuch, according to the Indian context, eunuch means a person who is born biologically male by force, or a person who is born biologically male has some sort of genital cancer, and person going for operation, that person is considered as eunuch. But when it's come to the transgender communities, we are having diversity of identities within the community, where hijras, kothis, jogapas, female-to-male transgenders, joktas, marladis, shivshaktis, and intersex, etc., etc.
Okay, so it's actually, when we use the term hijra, does that refer specifically to eunuchs, or is that an encompassing term for any sort of gender diversity or trans issue?
Yeah. See, hijras are part of the transgender communities. When you talk about hijra, it is a terminology used in the context of culture. The term hijra, it's basically a Persian language where, you know, hijras do have that recognition when it's come to the ancient periods. When Mughals were ruling India, from that point of time, people are existing in the world. Okay, if you want to become a hijra, you will have to be part of the hijra community, where you have to pierce your nose, pierce your ears, grow long hair, do sex work, do begging, and do badhai. Badhai means basically you are blessing children, you are blessing for housewarming ceremonies, you are blessing for marriage couples. So all this status will talk about hijra community.
So interesting. Maybe we can touch on that a little more. But you're saying they actually live as a hijra community. I actually read they live under maybe what it was called, like a guruji, in sort of a monastery of a kind.
Sure. I think that system is existing in the hijra community, where we speak about guru, chela, nati, santi. Guru means mother. Chela means daughter. Nati means granddaughter, like that. So that hierarchy, that structure is existing within the hijra community.
And that continues to be a system that is still employed today in India?
Absolutely. It is not only in the context of India. This system is existing in the South Asian countries. That is Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, Nepal, South Africa.
You touched on it a little bit. So what exactly, why do they live as a community? What sort of work do they do? Saying that they live specifically their own, like, hijra lifestyle.
The hijra community lifestyle is dependent on three things. One is sex work. One is begging. One is badai, as I said. Why these community members are indulging in sex work, begging, and badai is because of social rejection. When a person is born biologically male, feelings are feminine, wanting to become a woman. The women's section is not accepting you as women. Same thing with a person who is born with biologically female and feelings are masculine, wanting to become a man. Then the men's section is not accepting. The social rejection, when you're behaving a feminine person in your own family, the family throws you out of the family. Because family is always worried about your prestige. Family is always worried about your dignity. Family is always worried about their religion, their class, their ethnicity. People are more into that. The spaces in India for transgenders are completely closed.
I see.
Very few families are accepted their children as they are. But majority of us, we are thrown on the streets. We are still searching for the safer space.
I see.
Due
so
to social... Yeah,
these communities are actually formed out of necessity.
Absolutely.
And is there any kind of religious requirement or religious encouragement for Hijra to live as in that system?
See, in that way, in Bible, in Quran, and in Bhagavad Gita, and in Mandir's so-called books, Hijras have a superstitious spaces. You know, a respectful spaces in those books when it's come to Quran, Bible and Bhagavad Gita. But when it's come to the practicality, the social stigma is existing against this community. Because people see Hijras as God and Goddess. People do respect. People take blessings from us. But when it's come to social status, when it's come to an identity, when it's come to using of public spaces like public toilets, public transportation, passport, or getting a voter ID, getting a driving license, or going for marriage, going for adoption, going for inheritance rights, these are all rejected by the society. The amount of fun the society makes at you, because you are a person in between with men and women identity, the people throw stones at us. People throw eggs at us. People rape us. People kill us. People abuse us. But very saddening that no one is worried about our communities. I'm so glad that the Bible, Quran and Bhagavad Gita have quoted very positively about transgenders. But very saddening that they are not practicing when it comes to practicality. So what happened to society's mind? What happened to society's social acceptance? You know, why does they beat us? Why does they kill us? Why does they rape us?
I'd say, so you're actually saying that religiously, Hijra should have a better position than they do, and in practice, it's cultural, it's a cultural thing that sits on top.
It is not there, yeah.
I see, that's very interesting. It's my understanding that recently in India, I think maybe last year, there was a recognition that you could identify as male, female, or other gender, or a third gender, legally. Mm. Was this an effort of accepting of Hijra, and is it having that practical outcome?
In that way, I closely worked with the Honorable Supreme Court of India. When you see the judgment, which came on April 15th, 2014, the judgment day, and the year, there was a petition filed before the Supreme Court of India by NALSA. NALSA means National Legal Services Authority, has filed a favor petition in favor of transgenders before the Supreme Court of India. The judgment, before delivering a judgment, the Supreme Court of India has gone enormous issues of transgenders when it's come to social status, when it's come to cultural status, when it's come to economical status, when it's come to psychosocial status, and mental status, and of course the legal status as well. After hearing all the arguments, the court felt there's a huge diversity of identities within the Hijra community or the transgender communities, and recognizing there are people within the community who claim themselves as man, women, and transgenders. Okay? Taking up this legal dimension, each individual has a right to choose what gender they are wanting to belong to. So it's completely gender is something choice that person makes and not what society decides for them to protect their norms or to protect their culture or to protect their religion. It is not that way. The Supreme Court judgment is very, very positive and acceptance and has covered a large dimensions of sectors when it talked about identity recognition, when it comes to social recognition, when it's come to employment opportunities, when it's come to education opportunities. I think India in that way is better, more to speak up that positive change has happened in the meantime. But when it's coming back to the identifying as male, female and third gender, I think we are not for third gender. We are for transgender. Okay?
Okay.
If you talk about my identity, I shall go with I shall go with women identity. I don't want man. I don't want third gender. If the court said that it's third gender, I should definitely question back the society. And which is the first gender? Which is the second gender? And who decided this gender?
And you were noting that there was obviously that hijra work in sex work, but also with begging out of necessity, I guess is my understanding.
Yeah.
And also you were saying that they attend weddings and blessings of children and weddings and stuff like that.
Mm.
Where does that come from?
I think, as I said, when Mughals were ruling India, from the ancient period of time, hijras had that superstitious prestige of dignified kind of positions. Hijras were the protectors of Maharanis. Hijras were the treasurers of the kingdom. Hijras have the superstitious life. They were leading their life and they were more accepted. In the name of protection, in the name of so-called dignified positions, they were treated as something that some sort of auspicious, some sort of goddess belief. But coming back to the blessings, coming back to housewarming ceremonies, etc., in that way, in the whole India that is existing in the north part of India, and definitely not in south part of India. In north part of India, people still believe in hijra's blessings. They do call people to bless their children for their naming ceremonies, for their housewarming ceremonies, for their marriages. I think that is still existing. It is because of the old history that we all carry that way that is there. But my question is that, do you give status for hijras based on the cultural morality? Or do you cross beyond cultural morality when we talk about human rights? When we talk about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, are we speaking enough? And why are hijras facing so much of discrimination? Why are hijras are harassed by police? Why are the transgender communities are charged false case against us? Why are the hijra transgender communities are raped?
Yeah.
Why are people killed? I think so many questions will come before the table.
On the blessings, is it also the case in terms of the superstition that people are afraid of curses as well?
I'm really laughing at that way. I shall say that, Tal, I don't believe in curse, okay? Because hijras are born biologically male, feelings are feminine, wanting to become a woman. So that is our identity, transformation of that thing. But when it's come to the curse and blessings, personally, I don't believe that. Okay? And the same way, when it's come to curse, no, it's not that. I think it's somewhere threatening the society for demanding their own needs. You can't do that. But definitely we need to demand our rights to accept the society and not in the way, in the context of forcing people. So where we're talking about social inclusivity, we were talking about love, affection, care, and social inclusion, I think that has to go with that and not in the way of curse. But personally, I don't believe that curse. And people within the hijra community, some people do also believe curse, and some people they do not believe curse, but in majority people don't believe in curse.
Okay, and what about the wider, I know it's hard to summarize India as a single entity, but rightly or wrongly, that's not the point, but are they afraid suddenly that if they turn Hijra away, that they might be cursed by them?
I think in large, people are really scared about Hijra communities because like one person or two person misbehaving on streets, misbehaving in trains and harassing people, that will affect to a large section of the Hijra communities. Okay, in that way, the whole society, I think the majority of the society people are really scared about Hijras, and they hesitant to speak to us. They're really scared in that way to involve with us. I think when it's come to Bangalore kind of society that we are working with, 10 years ago, the situation was really pathetic and the society was really afraid. But now the same society is inclusive. People are inviting for college lecturer programs, for their housewarming ceremonies. But I think this is very, very open society in Bangalore. We can see the amount what the 10 years ago was existing is really very bad, but presently the things are moving forward towards acceptance.
Apart from Bangalore, where is it better for Hijra?
I think in that way, some part of the North India, that's Punjab, Delhi, Haryana, and South part, of course, Tamil Nadu is one of the progressive states that has come forward to accept transgenders.
Does places like Tamil Nadu have a history of accepting Hijra on a religious level?
Because Kuvagam festival, every year in the month of April, there is this festival called Kuvagam, where it is happening for more than 100 years. People are, being there and practicing the culture and ritual of the Hijras, that so-called Harmanan story. In that way, I think it has an enormous of acceptance, at the same time, enormous of rejection as well.
Do you think that things have gotten better for Hijra or worse?
I think especially after the Supreme Court judgment on transgender communities, I think the society is coming forward to know more about the Hijra communities and the diversity of identities within. That is one side. And of course, the governments are acting very positively in towards bringing laws, favor of talking of policies for transgenders. I think that is a big milestone. I think the governments are coming forward. If government is coming forward, of course, the society is also coming forward to accept that. But it has to be done simultaneously.
Do various groups within, so do trans and intersex and eunuchs, etc., do they get along within India themselves?
I think in that way, the movement is very strong in India. When we talk about sexual minorities, we don't segregate transgenders, lesbians, gays, bisexuals. We all come together to fight for one cause. When you go back to Supreme Court judgment on Section 377, which again recriminalized sexual minorities. In that way, the whole transgender, lesbian, gays, bisexual, intersex, queer communities, they all came together and condemned the Section 377 judgment, which was not acceptable, which is against the sexual minorities' human rights, which is against sexual minorities' dignity, and we did not accept the judgment.
Who sees Hijra for sex work? Who are their clients?
Okay, it's basically men. Men. Men.
Does it tend to be any in particular? Are they often married or are they often single? Or is it just there's not a pattern of any kind?
I think if you're standing for sex work profession, we get youngsters, we get middle-aged people, we also get old-aged people to have sex with us. Sexuality is something that diversity, people do have their different kinds of orientation, people do have their different kinds of choices. In that way, people prefer in that way. But sex work, when it comes to sex work professional-wise, people don't see their choices. People are there for money. As profession, they are demanding for money, and people, like all types come together to have sex, that's only men.
And I'm assuming that they are quite secretive about that they're visiting Hijra?
Pardon?
Are they secretive about visiting Hijra? I'm assuming they're not telling people?
I think it's secretive. It is secretive because no one will come in the public and ask to have sex. Very few situations are like that. The people standing on the street for sex work, the men come to Hijras to have sex with them, and they ask and negotiate for sex. And I think if that is picking up, then they go to hammams to have sex, then they go to lodges to have sex. I think that is taking place.
Why don't we talk a little about the organization that you are a founding member of, Ondere? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Very, very perfect.
So what does Ondere do?
See, Ondere is basically an initiative which is a group of feminists, activists, thinkers, writers, and academicians coming forward to form this group called Ondere, means convergence. We were looking in the context of dignity, voice, sexuality of children, women, sexual minorities. Taking up the context of dignity, voice, sexuality, I think somewhere the three movements, childhood movements, women's movements, sexual minorities movements are isolated. We were formed this group to bring it to a convergence mode and to talk about issues of dignity, voice, sexuality with children, women, sexual minorities. I think that was the whole idea of bringing up this group together and to fight for the better cause for this marginalized section.
So what sort of work have they done?
Presently, we are working on research, advocacy, policy, working with the religious leaders on religion and sexuality, working with the judiciary when it's come to the sensitizing the whole judiciary on sex, gender, sexuality, human rights, okay? And working with the government bodies very closely on sexuality issue, on gender issues. I think that is the work simultaneously we are doing. And of course, recently we did a kind of panel discussion on age of consent. Age of consent in three movements has different stands. I think that was a platform to coming together and understanding what exactly age of consent means to India. So that was the whole thing that we are doing in that way.
Maybe we can touch on that for a moment, but what are the issues with age of consent in India?
See, different people have different stand on that. When it's come to age of consent, what exactly age of consent means to a child, whether it is for education or for employment or for migration or for sexual orientation or to become a person that he or she is wanting to be. I think all these issues were burning issues which came to the forefront for dialogue and things like that. But finally, I think all the movements are together. So let the child have that environment or that space to decide what exactly she or he wants to be at certain age. So age of consent, presently it is crossing on 16 and 18. But some people are demanding that has to be for 14, and some people are demanding, it has to be for 12, and some says, no, it has to be for 21. I think all these contexts are in a dialogue, way.
On working with religious communities, as you said that you do, how do you approach a religious community about becoming more accepting of sexually diverse people?
I think that is very simple for me because I'm constantly working with all the religious leaders when it's come to Muslims, when it's come to Christians, when it's come to Hindus and Jainism and Sikhs. I think the issue is very simple, which is unspoken. Sexuality means people with orientation, with choice, with preference, with preference, orientation, choice, and, I think there's someone, I think there's another word.
I'm not sure.
Okay, so that way, so we take up that issue when a person is wanting to become a homosexual or a bisexual or a pansexual or a heterosexual. It is up to person's orientation. where the religious morality the caste morality or the so-called political morality will not impact on sexuality, because it is up to person's orientation, and we cannot influence person based on their thoughts or their belief against certain communities. If that is done, people are losing their lives, people have been killed, people have been, you know, forcibly married. I think taking up this agenda and looking in the context of each religion, when it comes to the Christianity says homosexuality is sin. But if you go back to Pope Francis' statement in 2012, which is very clear, the Pope Francis said, you know, but I'm going to repeat it here, a person who is gay and believes in God, who am I here to judge? But when it's come to Islam, but when it's come to Muslim religion, they clearly say that it is sin. Okay, if two men sleeping together, then we can punish them as a death penalty, like killing them, and after seeing that killing on the blood, I think that is more, it's a way of violence. Okay, and what about people within the Hindu culture, within the Hindu religion, people, when it comes to sculptures, temples, homosexuality is accepted. People are praying that. People are doing pujas there. But when it comes to practicality of homosexuality, even the Hindu religion is not accepted. My question is very simple to all the religious leaders, saying that when you talk about sculptures, thing like that, and sin, etc., I think there's a need to go beyond that. You will definitely need to speak about human sexuality. And of course, not all religious leaders are against homosexuality. When I go back to the religious leaders that we are working with, Swami Agnivesh, Sri Sri Ravi Shankar Guruji, Bishop Sagar from the Christianity, NCCI, you know, Betisk, and of course, Mr. Salim Kidwai from the Islam community, are coming forefront, and of course, this person called Irfan Engineer has come forward to support homosexuality, to support human sexuality, to support human sexual diversity of identities within the communities. I think in that way, very few fundamentalists are opposing homosexuality, and that is not should be. I think the space to acceptance for sexuality, that society we need to see. And we can't judge people based on sex. We can't judge people based on their gender or sexuality. Of course, when you talk about nature, we are part of nature. If a person who is becoming a homosexual or being a homosexual or a sexual minority, have any God said to reject them? No. No God has said. Of course, within the sexual minorities, we also believe in God. We also go to church. We also go to mosque. We also go to temple. But there we are facing discrimination. People are making fun of us in temples, churches and mosques. Why is this? Where is God?
Akai, thank you for talking to me here on the Spirit Lounge. It's been very, very informative. I hope it's been very informative for our listeners as well.
Thank you.
And good luck for all of your work.
Thank you so much, Tal. Same thing there.
Thank you. Bye.
Yeah, bye.
More information about St. Valentine's Day. So it's believed, some people believe that Valentine's Day is celebrated in the middle of February to commemorate the anniversary of the death or the burial of St. Valentine. But others claim that the Christian Church decided on this date in an effort to Christianize the pagan celebrations of Lupercalia. Is that how it would be pronounced?
I would pronounce it that way. It's interesting that we've Christianized another
pagan
event. Yes.
Yes.
What was that pagan event of Lupercalia?
So it's a festival that's dedicated to Faunus, the Roman god of agriculture, as well as to the Roman founders Romulus and Remus, which is very interesting that they wanted to Christianize that.
Very much so. It's, but then again, I suppose we have Christianized a number of events, so I suppose in a sense it's not surprising that that has occurred.
That's very true.
The festival, though, was a festival where Roman priests would gather at a cave, and they'd have two infants, Romulus and Remus, who were the founders of Rome, and they were believed to have been cared for by a she-wolf or a Lupa, which obviously is where the name comes from, Lupercalia. Mm. The priest would sacrifice a goat for fertility and a dog for purification. They would then strip the goat's hide into strips. They'd dip them into sacrificial blood, and they'd take to the streets, slapping both women and crop fields with the goat hide. It doesn't sound all that enticing to me.
Women and crop fields, very similar, right?
Now, what I read is that the women weren't fearful of this. In fact, they welcomed the touch of the hides because they believed that it would make them more fertile in the coming year.
Yay, please slap me with some raw goat covered in blood.
And it's said that later in the day, after that festival activity has taken place, the young women in the city would place their names into a big urn, and then the bachelors would each choose a name and become paired for the year with their chosen, well, I don't know about chosen, that doesn't quite seem the right name, but with their lottery chosen women. And I'm told that the matches often ended in marriage.
That is fascinating. So, as we're talking about things being Christianized, we're now going to say that it was de-Christianized, if that's a word.
That's an interesting way of looking at things.
Look, I will make up what I want to make up. So in 1969, a revision of the Roman Catholic calendar saw that St. Valentine's Day needed to be removed, basically because they don't have enough information about St. Valentine, except that he was buried on the Via Flaminia on February 14. So they've removed it from the Roman Catholic calendar.
Which does pose a question. Why would you remove someone from a feast day if you'd already put them there?
Yes.
Surely there was a reason to put them there in the first place.
I think they just decided that Valentine's Day has become too commercial, and as our text message before said, they 100% agree that it's definitely a very commercial day, so maybe the church just wanted to disjoint themselves from that notion. So some other fun facts. In Europe, on St. Valentine's Day, keys are given as a symbol, as an invitation to unlock the giver's heart.
That's interesting.
Yes.
I remember receiving a key for my 21st birthday.
Yes. So imagine if your birthday was on the 14th of February and your parents gave you a key.
That would seem a bit
odd.
That
would be odd.
It would indeed. But the feature of giving, the thing to do there, was even happening back in the 18th century. So 18th century would be the 1700s, wouldn't it? I think that'd be right. 1700s.
You seem like you would be more about history than I, so yes.
In England, where the lovers gave flowers and lollies and cards.
Yes.
But I'm assuming back then they would be hand-created cards, handwritten cards.
I did read that it became very popular businesses to actually make cards out of lace and, like, cutting up the paper into lace-like shapes. And that's when love hearts began to be a part of it, because it was easier to cut a love heart than it is to cut out lace.
Now, that's not a bad idea.
Yes.
And in recent times, or more recent times, you get the hearts, but being commercially produced with the lace pattern as well.
I've
seen a few of those around. But yeah, very, very commercial, I think, these days. It has obviously lost the Christian aspect, because all you see these days is cards, flowers, lollies, chocolates, all sorts of things.
Yeah, well,
clothes.
You certainly don't even hear it being referred to as St. Valentine's Day. It's just Valentine's Day.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, there was a bit of confusion as to why Valentine's Day existed. A poet named Geoffrey Chaucer wrote a poem in 1382 titled Parliament of Fowls. It's French, so I'm not very good at pronouncing French words, but it features the line, "For this was on St. Valentine's Day, when every bird cometh there to choose his mate." This poem was written to honour the first anniversary of the engagement of King Richard II to Anne of Bohemia, but there's still controversy around that, as is that Valentine's Day, because the date doesn't really match up, because it's too cold for birds to mate in England at that time.
Although I suppose in terms of being creative and artistic, if you write something and it doesn't sound right, you put something else in to make it sound right.
Yes, and birds choosing their mate is beautiful, so you know, maybe it just worked for that. So that was another theory as to where the love side of Valentine's Day came about.
There do seem to be so many different little stories and anecdotes around St. Valentine's Day that just fill the research time that we've had, and obviously have been created for various reasons over the years. It's amazing, really.
Yes, so no doubt it's an internationally celebrated holiday now rather than a religious day.
And we get to celebrate that on Saturday, February 14th, St. Valentine's Day here in Melbourne, with, of course, Cupid's Undie Run happening, yes. Raising some much-needed funds as necessary there. You are listening to Rachel and David on the Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9.
So thanks for listening tonight. Tal will be back next week after his exciting adventure off tonight, and we really appreciated his interview with Akai Padmashali. So thank you from Rachel.
And thank you from David.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.